There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say that there isn't. Why don't you come on back to the war? That's right, get in it. Why don't you come on back to the war? It's just beginning.
Welcome, everybody. This is Michael Belius for the 13th installment of Prosperity Marxism, our podcast brought to you by the Institute for Radical Imagination and the Situations Collective. I'm here with my co-host, Peter Bratsas, who is in Manhattan, and we're very pleased today to have as a guest Alex Vitale, the author of The End of Policing, a book that has resonated across international circles, much less national circles. Alex had the right moment in terms of a critical intervention, and we're very pleased to know him and be a part of an ongoing conversation here. The book, I think, was originally published by Verso in 2018, came out and was very critically acclaimed. Alex has been on, I know, multiple lecture tours, including to Iran, if I'm not mistaken. With our friend Heather Gottney. I don't know if you spoke about the book, but it certainly you probably spoke about policing there. Yeah.
That was before the book.
Before
actually.
The book, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I was asked to give a lecture at the University of Tehran about protest policing, which is something I've spent, decades writing right. about and working with police right. departments around the world. So, yeah.
Okay. We can certainly see that play out in the book. So, we'll talk about that today. Anyway, I want to welcome Alex. I mean, I found the book not only very informed and a very good critical, intervention from the position of the left. I really like the way Alex situates things, both by saying that, the deconstruction of racial hierarchies in the police organizations and institutions are not the answer, and this is something that we get a lot of on the left. I'm just going to give our viewers and auditors a sense of the book. Alex has 10 chapters with a conclusion, and the first chapter is really where he sets up this notion of the end, the limits, the end as limit to police reform. He begins there with the mindset that we have about police and certainly the notion of the warrior mentality, and we'll certainly extrapolate there as well. Then the notion that the police are here to protect and give you courtesy and respect is demystified throughout. Then the most interesting part to me, at least on the ground being an educator, the school to prison pipeline. Very, very interesting chapter. Then we called for help and they killed my son, which is actually an excursion into the mentally ill and the role of the police and not being trained to handle the mentally ill and how that's happened. Then the failures of policing sex work, in which later Alex calls for a legalization of both sex work and drugs. We can ask what drugs, but maybe all, right? And in a way, at the end of the discussion. Then the gang suppression, border policing, which interests me very much since I've been trying to get into Canada for over 10 months and I have a personal stake in this and very passionate about it. And then of course the political policing, interestingly enough, and Alex had mentioned that he also talked about protest policing. And then the very good conclusion. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. It's a great read for the people that enjoy good reads on top of very scholarly erudition. And so I'm going to let Alex maybe talk a little bit about what brought about the interest in police and policing. And I want to frame it first from my perspective, at least in a longer narrative, if you will. I grew up in the late 60s and the 70s. I kind of came in age in that period. And one thing that I noticed during the years of the so-called Reagan Revolution was that the police procedural became a very big cultural item. It began with the Hill Street Blues, where the police were sort of shown in their everydayness, their sensitivity, et cetera. And the police procedural morphed into Law and Order, as well as many other programs, as we know. And this became almost a dominant cultural form in terms of, you know, TV, primetime TV, and then, of course, syndicated TV. So this was a new ushering in of a new moment after the police as pigs, as we came up to grow, you know, learn about the police. And, you know, anybody that has seen footage of the 60s can see that on the protest lines and demonstrations, et cetera. And police was the worst word you could use, you know, in a sense. So I'd like to maybe kind of ask Alex first about his, you know, the motivation, the interest, and then also, you know, to maybe speak and contextualize the book a little bit vis-a-vis, you know, what you do. You set it in the framework of a neoliberal, you know, institutionalization of the police. And, yeah.
All right. Well, that's a ton to react to.
I'm sorry.
I loved Hill Street Blues. I was in high school at the time. Okay. I'm like half a generation behind you, I guess. You know, let's talk about that for a second. You know, Bochco was a huge entertainment innovator in this regard, and he transformed the police procedural from the kind of Adam 12 model of very clean cut, procedurally proper, to this edgier, more street focused kind of procedural. Still a procedural, but what this lineage shares is that this is about producing legitimacy for policing. And policing as an institution is a legitimacy-seeking organism. That's fundamental to its nature. Everything it does is rooted in this discourse around trying to find legitimacy for itself. So Adam 12 was created in 1968. The Mod Squad also, mm-hmm. 1968, and these were two different pop culture mechanisms for trying to restore legitimacy to policing in the wake of Watts and the urban uprisings occurring in the late 60s. Adam 12 takes the LAPD line, which is, we are professional crime fighters who follow proper procedure and enforce the law. We just want the facts. We just want to know what the law says, you know, and we don't mess about. So this is creating a myth about the LAPD, which is completely contrary to the actual experience of policing in Los Angeles and communities of color, which is experienced as racism and brutality, right. Abuse of authority, not following the law, right? So this is all myth-making, and it's co-produced by the Los Angeles Police Department, right? So this is just legitimacy seeking. Mod Squad, interestingly, which has a little more of an East Coast feel to it, takes a different tack, which is, we're a diverse group of hip young people who are going to fix policing by having it reflect the diversity and complexity of American society. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to pretend to be like race neutral or these things. No, we're going to be plugged in. And see, policing is okay now because we're hip to the street and we're just in it to get the bad guys. Bochco comes along and actually muddies the water and says, actually, there is a bad side to policing, but it's all in the service of getting the bad guys. And sometimes it goes a little too far with the SWAT teams and whatnot, but basically we're all just trying to get the bad guys. So my book, just to bring this all together, my book is trying to just call bullshit on all this and say we should not be attempting to find legitimacy in policing. We should be asking, what is the actual nature of policing? And what is it that policing enables? What is it that it makes possible? What function? So that's another sense of the meaning of the title, the end of policing, as in ends and means. Like, what is the point? Well, the point is, right, is that policing has always been created and existed to facilitate regimes of exploitation. So in the 19th century, when most police departments are created, those regimes of exploitation revolve around colonialism, slavery, and mass industrialization. And so we see police forces created to manage resistance to those forms of exploitation, to prevent slave revolts, to prevent working class organizing or the pursuit of working class pleasures that are considered disorderly or threatening or criminal, like taking rich people's things away from them because they're starving, right? And so today, we don't have, you know, slavery and colonialism in that 19th century sense. And in much of the US, we don't even have industrialization anymore. Instead, what we have is neoliberal, finance-led austerity politics. So what we've seen is this defunding of the social safety net and social services, the breaking of our movements, whether it's the labor movement, which has either been broken or has been mollified into a kind of empty business unionism. And also this transferring of wealth up the economic ladder through tax breaks to the rich, deregulation, and all the rest. And what that's produced is a new set of social problems around those regimes of exploitation, right? A polarized labor market that's produced mass homelessness, mass untreated mental health and substance abuse problems, mass participation in black markets like drugs and sex work and stolen goods. And then policing exists to manage those consequences of neoliberal austerity. Not to solve them, it doesn't solve anything, it just puts a lid on them. And then the same politicians who've enabled this problem, when we point out the racism and the brutality of it, they say, don't worry, we'll give them implicit bias training and you can go back to trusting the police. And so the book is an attempt to point out these historical realities and to point out the utter insanity of thinking we're going to fix policing by tweaking some use of force policies, hiring a few black police officers, giving them implicit bias training, making them wear body cameras. This stuff is all nonsense. And the officers involved in the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis had had implicit bias training, had had de-escalation training, had had mindfulness training, were wearing body cameras, were operating under a new use of force policy, were operating under a new accountability system, and it made no difference. Because George Floyd's life didn't matter to them, and it didn't matter to the elected officials who put that system in place.
Well, that's an excellent introduction to your book. Peter, you want to say something about
that? Yeah, and it's nice to see you guys, even virtually. You know, we all go back a long way, so I'm really glad to have this chance chat with you guys.
Yeah, we've known each other a long time, and Alex has been, and I know you've been working on this since the 90s, so finally, I think, things have caught up with you. What was an obscure position 20, 25 years ago now has become in many ways the dominant mindset that the police make things more dangerous rather than making things safer, you know, in many, if not most situations. But I think in addition to what you just said in terms of reframing the history, the historical narrative of policing, and tying it to these regimes of exploitation. I think what your book fundamentally does is a kind of imminent critique of policing in showing that the claim that these are things that keep us safer is for our own good is in fact just the opposite. That in most all situations, and I see each chapter, of course, as in a different context, why the current regime of policing, it makes things more dangerous. You know, in terms of sex work, in terms of course, the war on drugs, in terms of people who are homelessness and so forth. But it seems, I mean, I don't think this is the point of the book, but the point of the current discussion on how to overcome policing seems to me faces a certain contradiction, which is the argument is police, having police or the current regime of policing makes things less safe. And the counter argument is, if you get rid of police, things will be less safe. So if we have no police, the argument is, well, what happens when there's, you know, for example, something like people storming the Capitol building and you don't have armed personnel of the state to enforce a certain order, for example.
Of course, we did have armed people in place. Yeah, it didn't seem to help very much.
No, that's right. But imagine if there weren't any at all. I mean, then they called in the National Guard and there were, I don't know, 20,000 something armed guards. And of course, you know, things were not as chaotic. And what I contrast the current mindset of policing to is police as they existed in the democratic regime in Athens, in ancient Athens, where you did have police, but only slaves were allowed to be police. Citizens were banned from being police. Because on the one hand, there was a practical recognition that you do need to enforce the decision of the city at some point. You know, there might be a need, of course, where you need some kind of coercive apparatus to enforce some decision. But at the same time, you can't have citizens in a position of coercive power over other citizens because it negates the principle of equality. And the kind of mindset that someone who is a good cop might have, let's say, is the antithetical to the mindset you need to be a citizen. If you are servile and all you do is obey orders, that might be good for someone who is a member of the police, but it's not good for a citizen. You need someone who can think and who is capable of leading as well as being capable of following orders. So it seems to me that what we need is to get away from the liberal discourse on security and safety and to have some alternative political ethic around which to conceive of what a democratic or a just kind of police might look like. Because again, on the one hand, we can't negate the fact that there is a need in various circumstances for some kind of coercive apparatus. At the same time, of course, we don't want what exists now, you know, which is citizens in positions of power over other citizens, this kind of callousness that seems to be bred. You know, I have many students, as I'm sure you do too now, who are studying in the university with the intention of becoming, although it's always interesting when I ask them, do you want to become a cop? Because they're studying criminal justice. No, I don't want to become a cop. I said, well, why are you studying criminal justice? Oh, I want to be FBI, or I want to be some other category. There's some category that they think, well, that's not being a cop. I want to be, tobacco and firearms or whatever. These people are quite fine as they are now, but at a certain point in time, when they go through these kinds of trainings, when they live in that habitus of policing, you know, there's a transformation that obviously happens, and they become something very different from what they start out as. So how can we think of getting away from liberal policing to some other model? Because otherwise we're caught in this antinomy where, okay, you want more security and safety. That's your goal, but then you're sacrificing potentially security and safety.
Right. So, you know, the ancient Greek notion of policing, of course, didn't look anything like what we have today, right? Policing meant just broadly the regulation of society. So they were concerned with things like weights and measures and the operation of the marketplace and sanitation and all that. And it was a regulatory function. You know, it wasn't people with weapons patrolling neighborhoods, chasing people down. So, but let's go on to this idea of this idea of no police. So there are a lot of kind of false representations of what's going on here. And while there are clear statements by people in the movement about we want a world with no police, they're not talking about tomorrow. What people are talking about is we have a massive apparatus of policing in place that facilitates a very harmful set of economic and political relationships. And we need to do a few things simultaneously. We need to dial back policing. we need to dial back those systems of exploitation, and we need to use the state to manage harms in different ways, in less coercive, less punitive ways, less violent ways. So none of this imagines a world without harms. It just says we're going to try to manage those harms in a different way. And I, for one, try to lay out pretty clearly the idea that this is about a process. It's not about some predetermined utopian world that we're then going to try to reverse engineer our way into in some kind of teleological way. What we're going to do is we're going to look at, well, what do police really do every day? It turns out that they chase homeless people around, that they threaten kids to get off street corners. They patrol the hallways of schools. They go on mental health crisis calls. They do low-level marijuana buy and bust operations. This idea that it's that police are there to prevent violence is mostly a fantasy. They're reactive. They're not very effective at addressing violence. Now, at the same time, if we disappeared all police tomorrow, if we found some magic switch that doesn't exist, right, and we just flipped it off, would the loss of policing have consequences? Yes, I'm sure it would. I'm sure it would. Their existence in the absence of other alternatives provides a protective framework, you know, that prevents people, some people, from doing some kinds of things. But we can develop other infrastructures to accomplish that. And for many things, it would be significantly better with fewer harms. And this includes things like sexual assaults and domestic violence and youth. This is not just about the little things. Oh, they did some graffiti, they should get restorative justice. No, we could build this out to reduce the number of homicides, to reduce the level of interpersonal violence among intimate partners. We have very good concrete programmatic plans to do all these things. So it's not about, you know, the right wants to paint police abolition or defund the police as the only thing we've ever given you for public safety is police, and now these crazy people want to take it away from you, right? That's the line that's used to disparage the movement. And what we're saying is, why is it that policing is the only option we are ever given? Why can't we have community-based mental health services? Why can't we have community drug treatment? Why can't we have counselors and wraparound services for young people? Why can't we have community-based violence interruption programs and jobs for young people and all these things that would actually do a better job of producing safety without all the collateral consequences that go with intensive and invasive policing and mass incarceration?
So you think even staying within the discourse of security?
I think it's okay to do that.
You don't have to go beyond it necessarily to transform.
Well, I see now, of the three things I mentioned, right, dial back policing, invest and address regimes. So regimes of exploitation have to be addressed through some additional mechanisms, like reinvigorating the labor movement and creating better labor community, coalitions. We just had this great victory out at the Hunts Point produce market, which was, of course, required a high level of union organizing among the workers. But the reason they won was a massive outpouring of community support. These two things have to go together. So that work needs to happen. I'm not suggesting that all we need to do is rethink public safety and this will solve all our problems. I'm just saying we've created this false distinction, and we've seen this like in groups like DSA, where there are these camps that say defund the police as a distraction. It will alienate, you know, poor people who rely on the police. We got to focus on traditional workplace issues. Well, guess what? For huge numbers of Black and Brown people, they don't have a formal workplace. Their experience of capitalism and neoliberalism is the policing of their survival activities. The police are the boss. in a sense, right? If they're involved in black market activity, things like this. So if we're ever going to build a multiracial movement that links working class and poor people together, we have to talk about both workplace organizing and resisting the police state, because the police state makes this system possible and is how lots of poor people experience the state.
Yeah, I'd like to just return for a second to these regimes of exploitation. You know, I witnessed, and I'm sure you did too, Alex, we're both sort of in the neighborhood, the protection of the Barclays Center. It seems to me that the police are certainly much more interested in standing there to protect private property. And this seems to be, again, another issue that, you know, needs to be addressed. Ironically, as we know, the police usually come from working class families. It's a way out for a lot of people. You know, the old Trotskyist notion that the police defend exactly what they hate and should be against, but they end up defending that very thing that the capitalist system gives us. In that sense, do you see any way to break up that spectacle? I mean, I talked to a few, and I'm sure you have too, I mean, through your research much more than I have, but I spoke to several police people. It's their way of making a living. That's it. That's really what they care about, you know, in a sense. They don't go into this, you know, with a notion of community service or, you know, to help their fellow human beings, you know, et cetera. This is not a service sector job. You know,
for some people it is, right? Okay. Here, you have students, right, who think that this is how they're going to help the community, is to get the bad guys and to respond to calls for assistance. So my experience of policing is that most people, not all, but most people think it is a helping profession.
Okay, interesting.
And it's the only one that's hiring.
The teachers, Michael, most teachers think they're doing something good.
By Abel Ferrara movies. If New York gets more accomplished.
Look, let me tell a little story. I was giving a talk in Houston, and some police officers came, black and brown police officers. And they were like, when we were kids, you know, we hated the police. And we thought, hey, we want to do something positive. And policing is hiring, paying good wages, and maybe we can change policing from the inside. Maybe we can change the culture of policing. And they came to hear me talk because they thought, well, maybe he's got some ideas for changing the culture of policing. And I said, well, I'm sorry, guys, there's no changing the culture of policing. That it's a given, right? What we have to do is create other institutions. So I asked them, they were having a hard time wrapping their head around this because they realized they had failed to change the institution. They were like, it was a miserable failure. We couldn't change anything. And I'm like, that's right. There's no changing it. When you were thinking about going into policing, if you'd had the choice of policing or a job in the community, coaching football and mentoring young people for the same pay and benefits, which job would you have chosen? And they all laugh. They're like, oh man, you know, this is Texas. They would have loved to be coaching football. But they said, but there were no jobs like that. And I'm like, exactly. Why are there never jobs like that? And the police department is always hiring.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the issue here, right? Yeah, these kids need jobs. And yes, a lot of them would like to do something positive. They're not all, you know, pre-molded fascists or something, right? Certainly not in New York City. You know, these are kids from the neighborhoods of New York City mostly. But this is the only option. It's the only option. So let's give them better options.
Yeah, that's an obvious development, that as good, stable jobs have waned in most other sectors, the only booming industry in many places is law enforcement.
And then colleges create these criminal justice programs because they know those kids will get jobs. And so then criminology becomes about training police, not about thinking about how we define crime, the utility of these institutions, other way, right? So then academia gets captured into this technocratic technocratic pursuit of making policing more efficient and legitimate.
Right.
Yeah, right. Which is just a fundamentally unjust pursuit.
Put this in a more of a meta discourse. I mean, as we all both know, all of us know, the Geisteswissenschaft and the, you know, the social sciences or the spiritual or, you know, cultural sciences, really were overtaken by the Polizeiwissenschaft in Germany. And this was very, very, made it very possible for the mobilization of National Socialism and the fascist, moment of Hitler and company, and has been transferred here in many ways, the Polizeiwissenschaft. And I think it's a great point to say that the criminal justice is not really in it. You learn about what criminalization is, and you're not really thinking about justice, even though, as you mentioned, in Texas, yeah, of course, if I could be a football coach, you know, I'm going to go there, but those jobs are not there. They're for a very few people, handful of people, et cetera. So this is interesting, the way this structure of neoliberalism has come to reduce choice to that, you know, in terms of, as Peter mentioned, the good jobs, and as you well know too. So this is very, very good. I like the point in your book where you did some history. I certainly learned about the Bobbies. I thought that was a great story of the original police, in London, Robert Peel, right, from which the name Bobbies came from. Very interested in original police force, and how that became kind of like almost a signifier in London, you know, during 19th century industrial capital. It was going about the Bobby on the street as a symbol of security and law and order, and that legitimization was another thing. I think also—
And of course, the origins, right, the origins of that model, yeah, are, yeah, rooted in the English occupation of Ireland. And that's, yeah, the part of the history that doesn't get told in the standard, right, textbook.
That's right.
They just think Peel was this genius who dreamed up the idea sitting in a fancy club in London. No, he was in charge of the English occupation of Ireland and needed more efficient and effective means of putting down agricultural rebellions.
Yes.
And then he,
yes,
took that and transported it to London to deal with this massive influx of rural workers desperate for employment following the enclosures. They've been displaced from the countryside, flood into the cities. There are bread riots, they're forming unions, they're engaged in so-called criminal activity, and policing is created to put a lid on all that.
Absolutely, yeah. Another thing that I think is interesting that we really should talk about, and I don't know how much of this you do on your regular tours and talks, and I'm sure they're, you know, it depends to which audience you're addressing, but is this the militarization of the police, and really how much of a political economy this really is, and how difficult this is going to be to destructurate, and because of this is a new level of the bad guys within the department, a new level of, you know, of infiltration that's happened. And I'm sure you know and can inform us more about how much of surplus from the Defense Department experimentation on the streets of, you know, East New York, you know, Brownsville, you know, Hunts Point earlier, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
So maybe we can talk about that. This is a very important part of the political economy of policing and what we're doing.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a very important part. No? So okay. The Biden administration has just announced that they're going to bring back the Obama era restrictions on direct military transfers.
Okay.
And that they're going to limit the Department of Justice's use of private prisons. But these are incredibly superficial interventions. Right. So the Obama restrictions were like, well, you can't have a tank with an actual turret. You can't have bayonets. You know, it was like a very small number of things that very few departments had, but otherwise the floodgates are still perfectly open. And people can look at Jonathan Pfaff's critique of the private prison thing, which I'm almost totally in agreement with, and tried to get the Sanders people to take out of their platform. I think part of this is Biden's paying back the deal that he made with Sanders to support him. These were little things he's ticking off. Okay, so but more broadly, Police militarization is not just about the hardware and doesn't rely on federal intervention. This is about creating things like the war on drugs and the war on terror and the war on gangs and the war on disorder and all the right. We have this war footing, this war mindset, this war esprit de corps. It's reflected in the training. It's reflected in the mission of policing. And yes, it's reflected in police paramilitary units and various kinds of hardware. If the feds weren't funding this stuff, a lot of departments would be paying for it anyway. They would just ask for more tax money at the local level to do it. I just was on a call in Cambridge with the city council there. The police department is like, we must have these federal sniper rifles. And if you cut off the supply, we'll just buy them out of our own budget. And it's not that much money anyway. And it is a form of welfare for defense contractors. There's no doubt about that. But it's not, it's sort of a pittance. The direct transfers don't really benefit the defense contractors at all. It's the Homeland Security grants where there's that, which allows the direct purchase of the hardware. That is, you know, a new market for these contractors, but that's not what's driving this. Just like private prisons are not driving mass incarceration, this is gravy that's spilling off the table that people are trying to take advantage of. It's not the cause. The cause is that there are deep political structural advantages to creating these wars and mass incarceration. It's serving a profound political purpose for elected officials in both parties at all levels. And the rest is just crumbs that people are fighting over to get rich off of a person here or there. But really we have to ask, you know, what political functions does the war on drugs serve? Well, you know, Nixon created it to win over white voters from the South who had been historically Democratic in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. It had nothing to do with public health, nothing to do with public safety, nothing to do with, you know, a few dollars and cents. It was like, I'm going to mobilize this black resentment around the trope of the war on drugs so that I can stay in power and go to where the real money is, which is $1 trillion defense budgets and tax cuts for the rich and all that stuff. That's where the money is, not in a private prison contract here or there, right? That's millions instead of trillions.
Okay, interesting.
So I'm all for getting rid of these police paramilitary units and cutting off the supply of weaponry. It's not that I'm against all that. That is not going to fix our problem.
Right. Good. Josh, would you like to say something? You're with us today.
I see your head nodding down there.
I see you, scrolling down. So yeah, nodding your head.
Sure. I guess just thinking about your response to Michael's last question, I guess my question has to do with the recent riot at the Capitol building by the alt-right movements. I think I saw reported that at least some of them were related to police or the police culture, and that even many of the Capitol police themselves may have been involved in enabling some of the rioting. And I guess I'm just wondering, if you think any of this has sort of taken a new dimension in light of all that's occurred around the riot.
So, you know, I did a long piece with NPR about this on the for Code Switch so people can see the longer version of this. But basically, two things are true here. One is that police have within their ranks a lot of people who are very sympathetic to these right-wing movements. We've got the head of the sergeants union here with a QAnon mug on his bookcase when he does interviews, right? We know police were part of the protests. We know police were supportive of the protests. So that's all true. There were Capitol police who were heavy Trump supporters. That's all true. What's also true is that that does not explain what happened. Right? This was a failure at a very high level. This was not about a few officers with a wink and a nudge saying, come on, let's do, you know, this was a structural decision made by both the mayor's office of DC, a black woman, and the political security leadership within Congress, the sergeants at arms for the House and the Senate, who said, no, we don't want the National Guard camped here. We don't want any of that. It'll look bad. We got a lot more to learn about what was driving that, but the decision was made way up high. And the mayor of DC was like, yeah, it's going to look bad. We got a lot of grief for over-policing Black Lives Matter. Now we want to take a softer touch. So this is a political problem. And of course, the mobilization of right-wing violence is not going to be fixed by throwing a few protesters in prison. It's going to be fixed by getting rid of the billionaires who are funding that movement, the elected officials who are enabling it and encouraging it, and maybe, you know, deplatforming some of these crazy nut jobs who are getting rich, deluding people. There's no rooting out right-wing police. Police, that is what policing is. Police made up like a third of the membership of the John Birch Society. Police were integral to the Ku Klux Klan. Police were part of the anti-communist leagues and right-wing Catholic, you know, anti-communist groups. That's the history of policing. That's the nature of that institution. So instead of imagining we can have some political litmus test for police, we need to reduce the scope and intensity of their power in every way we possibly can so that they're not in a position to be in charge of these things.
The ridiculous position that somehow you're going to reform from the Palmer raids to the Pinkertons just through discourse. Yeah. I mean, in a way, this has a very, very deep and long history. I've been doing some work on the Hollywood, you know, 10, and you mentioned Red Squads. And of course, you know, during that period, you know, the levels of informer took on very different meanings depending on who was speaking, you know, and very, very, very interesting period in this regard of the policing from above, as you say, at the very high level by Congress, by, you know, of course, the McCarthy, HUAC hearings, you know.
And I come from a mixed family. On my mother's side of the family was a Pinkerton executive, and on my father's side of the family were all coal miners.
Wow.
So, I'm living at the intersection of those.
You didn't grow up in River Oaks, which is highly protected in Houston, right?
Well, I didn't grow up in River Oaks, no.
Yeah, I'm just playing.
Yeah, no, I didn't grow up there, right. No. But I am from Houston, right. Yeah, I know that. Right. I do know that area.
Right, right.
One of the symbols now of the far right is the flag, the thin blue line flag, has become synonymous increasingly, I believe, with these far right sentiments. Although, and the, you know, always justification was just about, you know, police. We don't,
it's just. I think one of the guys who killed that police officer in the Capitol raid, like, had a Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, thin blue line flag. I mean, they were using those flags to attack the police. It's so ridiculous, right? It's just political opportunism. It's really about right wing authoritarianism. These people don't actually know. The sad thing is the number of police who, you know, are in there with them, whatever. It's sad, but normal. So it's, yeah, this, so thin blue line starts as under the guise of like mutual aid. They were selling stuff to raise money for widows and children, you know, kill police and stuff like that. But it was always ideological, and it is, there's nothing politically neutral about it, right? It's about a worldview, a very Manichaean worldview that says the world is divided into good people and bad people, and we're here to sort that out, and we're going to X out the bad people and protect the good people, which is, of course, a gross misunderstanding of the nature of society, the nature of who commits harms, and, you know, it's just amazing that anyone would give any credence to these ideas.
Well, I mean, given how many people believe in QAnon,
I guess it's not so amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's much more. But thus, I think, you know, because I mentioned before the ancient democratic regime on policing, something like banning citizens from serving as police seems, given the current situation, would be a great step forward.
I'm not against it. I don't think you should have any illusions, because the institution, as you sort of pointed out, will turn whoever joins it into that.
Right.
Right. The field creates the habitus, to use your analogy, right? The field of policing, because it's violence workers in service of the production of order, is rooted in a right-wing Wiesenthal worldview, right? So it's going to produce this authoritarian mindset, no matter who we bring in at the front end.
If these people are citizens, the impact of that is different than if they were here as guest workers from Japan, or the Philippines, and they did their 10 years and then went back.
But would they be, but what would they do? They wouldn't, it wouldn't make us any safer, and we should just hire people from the community.
Comfort, according to Peter.
Yeah. What's that?
Security and comfort for Peter, hence the Japanese.
I think that would be a good deal. People in New York City, one of the police can be sent to Japan, and Japan would, send New York City there are people who want to become
police. Well, but we do that. We do that.
Much more respectful to the locals. They wouldn't have these implicit biases that...
They would have worse. The Japanese have horrible anti-Black racism. And, look at Stuart Schrader's book, Badges Beyond Borders. There's already a massive amount of international exchange in policing. So the police are talking to each other across borders and doing sharing and job transfer. None of that's going to make it any better. It's all in the service of American imperialism. So let's stay focused on what we're really talking about here. There's no imagining the officer friendly doing community policing. This is all just fantasy. It looks good maybe if you're a middle-class white person with no real problems, but then by embracing that, you're unleashing that institution on all these other communities. And part of what this moment is demanding is that we take responsibility for not doing that just because it makes us feel a little safer walking around the neighborhood, when we don't actually have to deal with real public safety threats most of the time.
So maybe we can turn this more into some real practical possibilities that you maybe, as you said, you worked with the Sanders campaign early. You've certainly been on the circuit now, I think close to 3 years, and maybe much longer in terms of your ongoing research. Maybe we can talk about what do you see practically possible in the next, let's say the next decade moving forward, outside of our own utopian speculations and our desires and, of course, our revolutionary urges always. What do you see as possibilities that maybe go beyond the standard reform, and I think you do a very good job in the book. One thing that impressed me was the ability to take apart reform and reformism in this institution. So maybe we could, talk about that.
So Austin is voting this week whether or not to spend $6.5 million taken from the police budget to buy two hotels to create permanent supportive housing for homeless people. That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
Right? The city of Albuquerque is creating a new public safety institution that's run by people in the health and social services departments that's going to redirect 911 calls to non-police crisis units to deal with substance abuse problems and homelessness and mental health crises. This is happening all across the country. Denver just rolled theirs out. Houston is working on one. San Francisco rolled one out. Portland just rolled one out. Oakland got rid of its school police. Portland, Maine got rid of its school police, right? These are very specific, concrete interventions that are happening right now in the normal budget process. There are utopian, radical, revolutionary ideas at work here, but this looks like going to a budget hearing and lobbying city council members. It's very normal politics for the most part. And yes, protests and disruption, which is also part of the long history of normal politics. So what we're going to see, and I have been traveling the country remotely this last year and in person for 3 years before that, what we're going to see is a continuation of these local budget battles to shift resources.
So the Michael Mentzer, our friend Michael Mentzer, the participatory budgeting program as being one avenue that could be really productively used?
Some people are talking about that as one mechanism for thinking about reparations or how do we we want to put more monies in communities. How do we decide what to do it? So participatory budgeting might be one mechanism for doing that. There are other ideas out there. I think we need to be doing community-based needs assessments. So we need to figure out what do people actually need help with? What are the actual drivers of harm, including things like there's lead in the water or employers are stealing our wages, right? Those are harms for poor communities too. In fact, in some cases, they're much more devastating harms. And so what's our plan for dealing with that? Mm-hmm. Let's put everything on the table and then let's look at a huge menu of options based on what other people are doing or whatever we can kind of come up with that doesn't rely just on coercive and punitive interventions.
Right.
So that's what the movement's looks like. And we're going to see dozens, if not hundreds of cities with really vibrant, defund the police campaigns this year, I think.
Excellent. And you see anything happening in New York City of substance?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, there's this mayoral and city council races are happening. And I'm talking to candidates every day who are trying to figure out how to talk about this in a way that they can win elections. Right. Mayoral candidates, city council, DA candidates, borough presidents. I've got a huge list of people and documents I'm reviewing. They're all working on this. So there's going to be a huge amount of political discourse. Tiffany Caban, who's running for city council in Queens, has an amazing plan she's going to be rolling out that I've helped to work on with a bunch of other people that's going to, I think, set a kind of gold standard for getting the police out of sex work and drugs and homelessness and youth violence and schools and all the rest. It's very concrete, neighborhood-based, really excellent. At the same time, there's a massive constellation of advocacy and organizing groups who, some of whom supported reforms and accountability strategies in the past, who are all now focused on defunding the police. So we're gonna see very concrete calls for shifting billions of dollars out of the NYPD budget. And we're gonna see, I think, really developed campaigns around mental health crisis response, school policing. And I expect to see, if not this year, 2022, really major victories here in New York.
Okay, great. Okay.
It seems like in the context of moving to the right steadily and things getting worse, this is the one bright spot in terms of contemporary political developments that, the critical understanding of the effects of policing in the United States has become more and more widespread. And really, I think it's to Alex's great credit that, he was on this issue so early on and has done so much to make this, a national issue.
Well, thanks, Peter. I mean, it's just me and a lot of other people, but yeah.
It's the only place we see a sign of progress, really, to be honest, from my standpoint. And, again, it kind of gives a little bit of credence again to the old protest and resistance activity, how it can manifest itself in what you're coming up with, concrete proposals and actual, material manifestations of these proposals.
Well, and I think we should look at something like DSA, which is trying to create organic linkages between labor struggles, racial justice struggles against the criminal justice system, and electoral politics. And, you know, it's imperfect, it's messy, but I think they're at least on the right track here in trying to think this through in a way that's focused on organizing and mobilization and realizing power, not just let's just think it through as an intellectual exercise. And I've spoken at dozens of DSA chapters over the last 4 years and just tremendously impressed with the attention to detail, the focus on organizing, and generally very good politics.
Interesting. Okay.
So get in the game. Get in the game, folks.
Okay.
We need more thought leaders, researchers to be in the struggle.
Great. Are you in touch with the abolition democracy movement and the critical I'm sure you have people and had conversations with them, right?
Oh, every day. I mean, that's what I do all day, every day.
Right.
Is I'm in touch with these people. You know, I've been working with critical resistance almost since its founding.
Yes, right.
And they just sent me a t-shirt. I just came out of the laundry for the first time. You know, anyway, I'm very, very close with those folks. They're like, oh, someone in Fresno needs advice about something. Will you talk to them? Let's do an event in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, listen, I thank you so much. I know you have a busy schedule, and thank you for taking the time out with us. You know, we're planning a Left Forum online conference, and we'd love to have you maybe on a panel with like-minded people. It'd be great to have the Left Forum really speaking to this, because as Peter mentioned, this is one of the very few places that there's been a modicum of progress.
And not like-minded people.
Yeah,
I'm happy to talk to them too.
Okay.
Some people need to be talked to about these things.
Yes. Okay. Great. Okay. Sounds great. Well, thank you again. And thank you so much for the work. And I personally, you know, I'm a big critic. I really enjoyed the book. Is beautifully written and, very accessible, can be used at the undergraduate level all the way up to, you know, the
top. Being used in high schools. Being used in high schools, I found out.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, it's a great idea. Yes, indeed. Yes. So, so hopefully maybe we can do this again and review the advances in about six.
There'll be a second edition of the book out later this year. So maybe we can use that as an excuse to talk again.
Yes, great. Okay, well, thank you so much. It's great to see
you. You bet. Great to see you guys.
Take care. Okay. Thank you, Alex.
There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say that there isn't. Why don't you come on back to the war? That's right, get in it. Why don't you come on back to the war? It's just beginning.